Hello and welcome to the Stinging Fly podcast. My name is Ian Malini. I'm the online editor at the magazine. On this podcast, we ask a writer to choose a piece from our archive to read and discuss. On today's episode, we have Mark O'Connell. Mark is a writer based in Dublin, and he's the author of two books, To Be a Machine from 2017 and Notes from an Apocalypse, published earlier this year by Granta. He's also written for many magazines and newspapers across the world, including The New Yorker, Slate, and The Guardian. He won the 2018 Welcome Book Prize for To Be a Machine and the 2019 Rooney Prize for Irish Literature. Mark has chosen to read Blank God, Notes on Mark Zuckerberg, an essay from our summer 2018 issue written by Roisin Kybird. Roisin is a writer and journalist from Dublin who has written several pieces for The Stinging Fly, and her writing about modern technology has been published in The Guardian, The Dublin Review, and Vice's Motherboard, where she wrote a column about internet subcultures. Before we start, I just want to thank the Arts Council for their support of The Stinging Fly, which makes this podcast possible, and to say that you can subscribe to this podcast wherever you get your podcasts. If you leave us a review, that really helps us out.
Okay, that's recording.
Here's Mark.
A year ago, in a charity shop on Capel Street, I found an expensive hoodie. Not expensive in terms of its current price, the Goodwill thrift shop was asking for €4, but its original one. The hoodie bore no outward sign of branding, but its design was strategically luxurious, sewn from the softest cotton and dyed to a muted achromatic grey. It had been designed to include the kind of thoughtful details you only notice on a second glance, and you realise the person wearing it is a little wealthier than they first appeared. Second-hand shopping is unpredictable. For every miracle find, that ludicrous, beautiful thing which has found its way to the charity shop by chance, there's the monkey's paw, the Dybbuk box, or the mysterious, probably cursed, item donated gladly by its former owner. There are broken electronics, outwardly fine appliances which won't switch on when you bring them home. There are shoes in your size which will still pinch and leave your ankles blistered. I might have laughed once at the idea of a designer hoodie, but touching its fabric, I felt myself converted. I pulled the zipper, looked inside to read the label, and noticed spidery text across the back on the inside lining, making the world more open and connected. It was a hoodie given to Facebook employees, likely donated to the shop by someone who had recently left the company. If walking around wearing Facebook's mission statement was a squeamish thought, then walking around wearing it secretly, printed on the inside of my clothes, made me feel even more uncomfortable. I put the hoodie back on the rail and moved on. Late last year, a group of writers took Zuckerbergian semiotics, including the hoodies he wears for his public appearances, as the subject of a collection of essays. Volume 1 of the Californian Review of Images and Mark Zuckerberg was published in November 2017, edited by Tim Huang, a fellow at NY Research Institute Data and Society, whose CV also includes positions with the Electronic Frontier Foundation and Creative Commons, a journal of essays on the cartoon Adventure Time, and 2015's Kickstarter-funded The Container Guide, a field guide for spotting corporate shipping containers. Each essay in the California Review of Images and Mark Zuckerberg addresses an image posted to Mark Zuckerberg's Facebook timeline, once pre-approved by the Facebook founder and his team, before being published to his 101,047,691 followers. Zuckerberg's carefully stage-managed presence runs through these essays as a common thread, prompting questions about mediation and identity, both Zuckerberg's and our own. Mark Zuckerberg's identity is directly linked to that of every Facebook user, because Facebook, his product, is an identity machine. The site feeds on our identities and all the monetizable ad data they generate, even as it encourages us to manufacture new ones. More than any form of interactive media before it, Facebook foregrounds the personal brand, a public-facing online self. Amid the noise, the emotional and visual clutter of the Facebook experience, Mark Zuckerberg is notable for his absence. While the founder has made occasional public appearances over the years and routinely publishes Facebook posts addressing his followers, his public image is subdued, carefully curated, and so ordinary as to be inscrutable. One essay, Mark Zuckerberg's Significant Insignificance by Delara O'Neill, addresses this theme using a 2013 Zuckerberg profile photo as its starting point. Here is Mark Zuckerberg, our current tech dude of the moment, who presents himself neither as a businessman or as a thinker, but as a normal guy. The image, a little grainy and likely taken on a now outdated phone, features the Facebook founder standing against a landscape which might be the surface of a distant planet. Blank, wide-eyed Zuckerberg poses before blank and rolling hills under the kind of sky artists in Hollywood were once paid to paint as background scenery. His appearance could be called youthful, but Zuckerberg has not noticeably aged in the last 10 years. He appears then the same as he always has. This picture might be a selfie. It might have originally included people who were cropped out. It might also be revealing, but it's not. Zuckerberg's expression is placid, impenetrable, generic, like a child's drawing of a human face. O'Neill looks for meaning in the landscape instead, casting Zuckerberg as its conqueror. Facebook is not just a website like the ones that came before, which stayed stagnant until consumers grew bored and moved on, with its constant updates and algorithmic strategies to infiltrate users' information. It unleashes onto untouched land and, like nature, will continually evolve. Mark Zuckerberg is defined by the community, the product he has built. O'Neill compares Zuckerberg to MySpace Tom, everyone's friend, the guiding figure who adds you on arrival on MySpace and leads you through the social media underworld. Certainly there are similarities. You get the sense that Zuckerberg would love to be everybody's friend, if only he could make himself more likable. But Zuckerberg is not likable. He has middling to negative portrayals of himself to contend with. Kate Loss's memoir of working at Facebook in its early days, The Boy Kings, portrays him as young, guileless, and more than a little bit entitled, while David Fincher's film biopic, The Social Network, casts him as inept, bordering on sociopathic. In interviews, Zuckerberg comes across as clear-eyed, but lacking in self-awareness. Another essay, Mail Hogan's Sweaty Zuckerberg and Cool Computing, takes as its subject a video rather than a picture, discussing a somewhat notorious interview from 2010. At the Wall Street Journal's D8, an executive conference promising straight-up unvarnished conversations with the most influential figures in technology, the 26-year-old Zuckerberg is grilled by journalist Kara Swisher. Visibly sweating when asked about Facebook's privacy settings, he refuses to take his hoodie off, displaying the awkwardness which has come to define his public persona. Beyond the images discussed in these essays, what do we know about Mark Zuckerberg, the fifth wealthiest person in the world? What does he stand for, apart from the cause of Facebook itself? This question might connect to a larger one. What does Facebook itself stand for? The hoodie's slogan, "Making the world more open and connected," has since been discarded as the company motto. In 2017, Facebook announced a new and equally innocuous intention to give people the power to build community and bring the world closer together. The world was open before Facebook, a time when communities existed just fine. It could even be argued, especially in light of the 2016 US election and its fallout, that services like Facebook actively narrow our perspectives on the world by only showing us what we want to see, reinforcing the effects of the internet's filter bubble, named by Eli Pariser in his 2011 book of the same name. In Zuckerberg and the Imaginary Cosmopolitan, Ethan Zuckerman argues that Facebook's effects are in fact often the direct opposite of an expanded worldview. Facebook welcomes us into its service by asking us about our past, our place of birth, our elementary and high schools, our colleges and jobs. For the 50% of Americans who live within 18 miles of their mothers, Facebook is more a tool that deeply anchors us into our communities than connects us to distant ones. Silicon Valley's Big Five, Google, Apple, Facebook, Amazon, Microsoft, and their disruptive heirs, Uber, Airbnb, and others, share a common response when faced with criticism. If a violent, bigoted, or otherwise objectionable video appears on YouTube, or a hate group forms on Facebook, or if your Uber driver tries to rape you, it is never the fault of the company. This is because the company does not employ this driver or endorse any of the content its users create. They may not even be aware of it because the platform is too big. This system acts against its workers too. An Uber driver does not have the rights of an employee because they are not technically an employee at all. Lacking the grassroots values of early internet culture, where users were relied on to police themselves but retained some right to ownership of their content in return, platform capitalism blames the user when anything goes wrong, mocking them for being misguided enough to trust the service in the first place. The modern tech company is more platform than company. It is a blank, hungry canvas which swallows up and monetizes its users. Facebook has long exemplified this approach. While Facebook's reps pressure media outlets into paying for more native advertising, the company denies that it is a media company itself. Zuckerberg embodies this same absent quality, a resplendent blankness paired with power too prodigious to define. An instigator of an open and connected world, little is known about his private life. We know that he dropped out of Harvard, where he took a joint major in computer science and, interestingly, psychology. We know he has a wife, Priscilla, and two daughters named August and Max. We know he jogs regularly because he posts photos of himself jogging on his Facebook page. We know that he worries about surveillance because he covers the camera on his laptop with a sticker. It appears in the background of a 2016 photo posted to celebrate the acquisition of Instagram, discussed in the essay Consequences of the Frame by Melissa Lowe. We know that Zuckerberg owns a 700-acre estate on the Hawaiian island of Kauai and has built a wall around it, 1 mile long and 6 feet high. We know he has filed lawsuits against hundreds of Hawaiians in order to settle disputes over land. We also know that Zuckerberg enjoys hunting his own meat because he announced in 2011 that his New Year's resolution was to eat only what he hunted. Pictures followed, soon after, of Zuckerberg grilling shanks of beef on a barbecue and holding a dead chicken by its legs. Zuckerberg, apparently, is so fond of meat that for his birthday, his employees gifted him a meat-shaped cake. In 2012, he announced that his hunting challenge was over via a connected steak app called iGrill. We also know, or at least I know and believe that it will eventually be universally acknowledged, that Mark Zuckerberg is the progenitor of normcore. Normcore, the millennial fashion trend, is what it sounds like, a celebration of mundanity in all its wearable forms. It involves ill-fitting denim, clumpy orthopedic trainers, and oversized machine-worn cotton sweatshirts with ill-chosen fonts and dodgy graphics. First identified in 2012 by trend forecasting group K-Hole in their paper Youth Mode, a report on freedom, normcore involves wearing clothing so cartoonishly basic as to resemble a character from Seinfeld or from Microsoft's 90s IRC client Comic Chat. Normcore is the look of an ordinary, gormless, apparently decent person, someone so generic as to not show up on CCTV. Normcore is at least in part a response to criticism of millennials as decadent, self-involved, and lazy, because no one whose style is this utilitarian and bland could possibly be a bad person. Zuckerberg's style is normcore at its purest. He wears fleeces, hoodies, dad jeans, and Adidas sandals, christened the fuck you flip-flops in The Social Network. His apparently unintentional personal brand slots into an emerging archetype, that of the self-neglecting, socially inept Silicon Valley wunderkind. The idea is to dress like a slob because you have no one to impress except other invariably young white male coders who pride themselves on their ability to sit in darkened rooms for days on end, typing and drinking Monster Energy. Mark Zuckerberg spent the better part of his first decade in the public eye wearing those same fuck you flip-flops and managed to get away with it without attracting too much scrutiny. His normality placed him beyond surveillance. He dresses in the same grey t-shirt and Facebook company hoodie every day, though in recent years the sandals have been replaced with trainers. K-Hole describes normcore as youth mode, the infinite newness of a world where history has been flattened by capitalism and the internet, where everything has been made open and connected and has already been seen. Facebook as a service enacts a similar effect. The user is fixed in eternal distraction, present and past joined together on an ever-scrolling timeline which appears to stretch back beyond the year you first joined Facebook, following its users into the womb. Facebook's algorithmic timeline means you digest news and updates on a timeline, but not in chronological order. Instead, Facebook calculates what you are most likely to want to see and shows you this first. In 2010, in an interview conducted with David Kirkpatrick for his book The Facebook Effect, Zuckerberg made perhaps his most infamous public statement, saying, "Having two identities for yourself is an example of a lack of integrity." This occurred shortly before the company rolled out its timeline feature, which streamlines individual user activity into a single scrolling feed. The timeline is curiously yet satisfyingly simplistic. It presents identity as a straight line with no complications, a self-forged in loyalty to Facebook over a lifetime. Sometimes I fantasize about interviewing Mark Zuckerberg. I would ask him the questions Facebook began asking me from the moment I first signed up. What films have you watched? What makes you happy? Add your relationship status. Add a life event. What we know of Zuckerberg himself is hardly enough to constitute a single identity. We know him purely by his luxurious blandness, his posed photographs, and his lengthy, ultimately meaningless statements about community building. We also know, if we read Kate Loss's The Boy Kings, that Zuckerberg used to work in a glass office in the name of radical transparency, but kept a secret private meeting room in the back. Where does the wunderkind go when he gets older? Does he settle into public life? Does he save the world? Or does he disappear entirely? Rumors abound that Mark Zuckerberg might one day run for US president. By touring America in 2017 and having photographers capture his visits with the ordinary people posted regularly to Zuckerberg's Facebook page, he already appears to be moving in this direction. Lee Cornfield's essay, Fireside Chats, Tech Spectacle and the Making of Mark Zuckerberg, brings Zuckerberg's presidential posturing full circle, comparing the fireside chats staged at tech conferences to those by the originator of the trend, Franklin D. Roosevelt, who made regular radio broadcasts throughout the Great Depression and the Second World War. Adopted by tech conferences like TechCrunch's Disrupt or South by Southwest, the fireside chat becomes a way to venerate powerful, fundamentally unknowable leaders while appearing to humanize them. The fireside chat is rarely revelatory because those judged important enough to merit the fireside chats are inherently protected from difficult questions. As an interviewing format, it conjures mediated intimacy, yet it takes place on a stage in front of thousands. What Zuckerberg represents, then, is a hive of connections, a cybernetic black hole which swallows up human behavior and regurgitates it as ad revenue. He is a seer, a keeper of memories. He pressures us to share, then ostracizes those who refuse. He encourages us to watch each other the way he watches us. In 2012, Facebook even instituted a snitch list, asking users to inform on friends who might be operating profiles under fake names. Salman Rushdie was targeted by the real name policy, along with a number of San Francisco-based drag queens who later took Facebook to court and won. What will happen when Facebook's filter bubble begins to work against itself, when accustomed to copying each other and liking the same things as the rest, we stop demonstrating the unique behaviors and interests which once made us useful as ad data? What about when we have nothing to offer, when we, like Zuckerberg, become so bland, so beaten down by peer pressure as to be normcore and beyond surveillance? Is Zuckerberg himself an augury of this future? Is he a benevolent god, a genius, or a warning? Is he Moby Dick, a sprawling white void of American power? Is it that by its indefiniteness, Melville asks, it shadows forth the heartless voids and immensities of the universe, and thus stabs us from behind with the thought of annihilation, a dumb blankness full of meaning in a wide landscape of snows? Might it be that Zuckerberg is not white, but cosmic latte, the distilled hue of the universe? It's painful to think of an ordinary young man having so much power and money and information. Easier to think of him as a robot, a savant, or a meat-hunting superhero. Easier to conceive of Mark Zuckerberg as a machine. To build a relationship with someone online is to draw them into a web of self-fashioning and to consent to mutual surveillance. With Facebook, this has happened in reverse. Facebook has seduced us and encouraged us to rebuild ourselves. We've been welcomed into a placid blue and white world where someone is silently watching, organizing our lives, making us feel like we deserve their attentions. It's as though Mark Zuckerberg loves us more than anyone else ever will. Perhaps this is why we tolerate the figure of Mark Zuckerberg. He will always be more boring than we are. He makes us feel like we are worthy of surveillance. We accept the friendship of MySpace Tom, the all-seeing eyes of Zuckerberg, and the promise that Elon Musk will someday find us a home on Mars. We sell our lives to Google because in return they make life easier by breaking it into actions and data segments. There are those among us who bask in surveillance, who dream of an NSA agent out there watching, checking in on us from time to time. A passage in The Boy Kings comes to mind here, written not about Zuckerberg himself, but about a video chat conversation between the author and someone she cared about. On screen, the feelings are simpler, easier to access, and more readily extreme. It becomes difficult to separate human from machine, mediation from emotion, selfishness from love. I think we could tell him we love him because he was so far away, and to love him is to love the technology that allows us to speak to him anyway, safely, intimately, from afar. Our technology ourselves. For us, at the heart of this revolution, they were increasingly the same.
Mark, thank you very much for reading that. The first question, as always, is why did you pick this piece to read?
Well, I just think it's a really good piece. I really like Roisin's writing generally. So when I was kind of flicking through the back issues looking for something to read, I came across her and I was like, oh yeah, Roisin, that'll be good. And it's just such a great piece. I love how, like a lot of great sort of essays, it starts as like a review and then sort of exceeds its boundaries really quickly and becomes about something that's almost like indefinable. Like I imagine it would be a very hard essay to pitch because it's like, it's about something sort of indefinable. It's about like trying to get behind the sort of blankness of the mask of Mark Zuckerberg. And I feel that it builds towards this kind of, not resolution, but this kind of like encounter with the sort of like almost cosmic horror. I mean, she goes in at one point into talking about H.P. Lovecraft, and I really identify with that. I really identify with sort of, you know, taking existing figures, you know, particularly kind of sort of like these kind of gigantic figurehead figures of global capitalism and turning them into kind of symbol, because that's all we sort of have in terms of like, you know, who they are. And I think she does it really brilliantly. I think she, like, you know, that passage about Moby Dick, and like when I read that passage, I just thought, yes, like I knew this was coming. Not that I knew it was coming as in it's predictable, but it just felt so perfect. It felt like this is where this was building to all along. There is something Melvillian about this like desire to sort of get past the whiteness of the whale and also failing at that. So yeah, I just really, really dug it.
Yeah, I mean, there's so much going on in it. I actually posted a link to this essay on a well-known tech forum the other day, just to see what kind of reaction it might get. And the sort of big question that got discussed as part of their discussion of this essay was, like, could Mark Zuckerberg be the president of America?
Hmm.
And I mean, what do you think? Do you think that could actually happen?
I've thought about this, not that intensely recently, but definitely, I guess, like after Trump was elected, one of the things that I was sort of, one of the many like fears that were swirling around in my kind of mental ether was that, like, what's going to be the reaction to this? Because America is always like swinging from one extreme to the other, one kind of reaction to a counter reaction. And I was kind of thinking, what is going to be the reaction to Trump? It's probably not going to be something good. You know, they're probably not going to snap out of it and elect, like, you know, a paragon of like democracy and, you know, social justice. They're probably going to overcorrect by like swinging towards some kind of empty signifier of, you know, rationalism and sort of, you know, inclusive kind of technocracy or whatever. And that person could well be Mark Zuckerberg. I wonder now whether I guess this essay is from what, 2018, isn't it?
Yeah.
I think like we've heard less of that since. And I think like, maybe this is just naive on my part, because like the obvious caveat you have to put in when you like talk about these things is that, well, no one really predicted like Trump getting elected, and that would have seemed just entirely absurd, you know, up to relatively soon beforehand, even the day beforehand for most people. But it just seems to me that like Zuckerberg doesn't have the presence. Like his whole point is that he, like, lacks charisma in this almost like surreal way. Like that's what Roisin is getting at in the piece, is that he's like, he's just like, he's a pasteboard figure, you know? There's like, there's almost nothing there. Which isn't to say that that doesn't fly politically. Like, you know, as soon as I say that, there are any number of like sort of figures you could point to who inhabit that space, including our own leader, actually. Yeah. But he just seems like he doesn't speak to like the American, either the American id or the American superego. And I think you have to do one of those two things, probably. I don't know. What do you think?
Yeah, I think I'd agree with you. I don't think he has a fantastic understanding of like symbolism or sort of abstract meaning, if you know what I mean. Mm. Which I think that's obviously what someone like Trump and Obama too, obviously with the different tenor to how he did it, but that's what they appeal to. Like you can't appeal to 350 million people on the basis of logic, you know, it doesn't, it's simply too varied. It's too diverse. Mm. You have to appeal to shared meaning between people. And I have never seen anything from Mark Zuckerberg that suggests he's capable of appealing to shared meaning.
Yeah. I mean, I guess Facebook and like Roisin does go into this in the piece, like Facebook is sort of rides this wave of its own bullshit in terms of like, you know, talking about connectivity and creating community and bringing people closer together and stuff like that. So there is like a rhetorical kind of register to his whole shtick that, I mean, it's certainly conceivable that it could translate politically. It's really hard to imagine him like giving a rally or, you know, like getting people, like getting a base fired up. Like, what would that even mean, you know?
Yeah.
Like most of the people who use Facebook, I mean, I haven't used Facebook in a few years at this point, but you know, people hate Facebook, right? I mean, most of Facebook's regular users kind of hate it. Unless maybe I'm sort of in my own sort of exterior bubble. I don't know, but he's not a figure who inspires anyone, right?
Yeah, I think that's exactly the issue. I mean, who's going to go knock on doors for Mark Zuckerberg?
Yeah, like there is something of the void about him. I think, I mean, that's what's so beautiful about this piece, is that she like really grapples with, like, in a way, like she's trying to like reckon with the appearance of Zuckerberg, because like in one sense, because that's all there is, but in another sense, because that appearance is so like weirdly, compellingly, disturbingly kind of strange, you know? There is something horrifying about Mark Zuckerberg. I think we can all agree on that. Like, you know, the Senate hearings and like any public appearance. I mean, I actually, when I was thinking about doing this podcast and I was reading the piece again, I remembered I had lunch sometime last year with Ben Grosser. He's an American artist and academic. And he went through every public appearance, every filmed interview, every public statement that Zuckerberg had made since like the very beginning of his career as a public figure, since like the very early days of Facebook. And some of the videos are just him in front of like, you know, a tiny crowd of like, you know, a half empty room with like 12 people in it or whatever, when he's in his like early 20s. And in every video, he isolates every time Zuckerberg says the word more, or the word bigger, or some kind of number. So it's like, I think it goes on for about like 3.5-4 hours, and it's like it's sequential. So it starts off with Zuckerberg as a very young man, and he gets like kind of older throughout the course of the film, and it's just like endless iterations of him saying more, 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 bigger, bigger, 52 billion, 62 billion, you know, like just numbers and figures. And it's just like, it has this, I didn't watch the whole thing because who has time to watch 4 hours of a conceptual art project of Mark Zuckerberg saying the same word over and over again. But it, like, even just to watch sort of 15 minutes of it, you get this sense of like, you know, gradually accumulating horror. And like, what is this man? What is his, like, to what end is he accumulating all this data? All these people, you know, what, like, it's almost like he's accumulating all these souls, and he's talking about them in terms of like, you know, the increase of his of his realm. And it's like, it's something weirdly kind of like blankly satanic about it. And I think that really chimes with what Roisin's getting at in her piece.
Yeah, definitely. And even just listening to you kind of put it that way, my mind went to Citizen Kane for some reason.
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh, it lacks some of the, I don't know, gravity of Orson Welles or the charm.
Sure. That's what's so fascinating about it, because someone like Rupert Murdoch, for instance, who probably would be the closest comparison to Zuckerberg in terms of like influence, like political influence and like outsized sort of, you know, malignant power.
Mm.
There's no sense that like, you know, Murdoch doesn't have a personality, you know?
Yeah.
Like the blankness doesn't exist with Murdoch. He's like, you can imagine Murdoch as a person. Like you can imagine him, you can imagine having dinner with him and like sitting across the table from him and being appalled at everything he says or whatever. But there's a person there, you know? Like, and that's in no means a value judgment. Like being a person is not necessarily a great thing. But, the blankness of Zuckerberg is something quite strange and sort of unique in its extremity, I think.
Yeah, definitely. And like the starting point of this essay, Roisin's essay, is a publication, California Review of Images of Mark Zuckerberg. That suggests obviously that he is a figure worthy of being sort of considered in a semiotic sort of way, particularly images of him, because his speech is so devoid of meaning. Most of the time, and obviously the title, you know, the whole publication is a little bit ironic, like it's kind of just academia having a little bit of fun, but there's also like there's a genuine serious side to it as well. And I was wondering, I mean, do you think there's value in using the strategies and kind of methods of the, you know, quote unquote humanities to investigate the world of tech and like particularly big tech like Facebook, which on the face of it seems so kind of resistant and even antagonistic towards the sort of habits and values of that critical thinking sort of tradition?
Well, yeah. I mean, I think like it's the first thing we all learn in our first term of like, you know, our English degree or whatever, is that, you know, the tools of textual analysis, like it's been a long time since those tools have only been focusable on texts themselves. Like the whole world is a text. Like that's kind of the lesson of cultural studies per se. And so I think, yeah, absolutely. I mean, there's so many great examples of like writers who do that. I mean, I don't like, you know, I'm not a big reader of academic work these days. But I see like really good reasons to sort of bring those tools to bear on someone like Zuckerberg and something like Facebook. It's too important to leave to, think piece writers and, you know, tech journalists and so on. Not that those people don't write really good stuff from time to time, but yeah, I think just to cravenly swing things around to my own work for a bit. I mean, like when I wrote my first book, I was sort of like, I went through a period of like being kind of bewildered by like the sense of my own inadequacy to like write about the tech world, because I didn't know anything about it. I know nothing about science even still. I know very little about like technology per se, or like the tech world in Silicon Valley. And so like there was a period of like myself asking myself that exact question, like, you know, what is the use value of bringing like my own sort of humanities background and education and thinking and sensibility to this world? And like, I guess I eventually kind of figured out that like, if I was going to read a book about Silicon Valley and transhumanism and so on, I would rather it be written by someone who wasn't an insider. I'd rather it be written by someone who was coming at it from like that other world, you know, from the world that I know, and writing about it as an outsider. And I think Roisin's like doing something quite similar here as well. Like I definitely have the sense of Roisin's work that like, you know, we're on a kind of a similar beat, obviously, and like approaching these things with a similar kind of sensibility. So that's part of why I like what she does so much, I guess.
Yeah, definitely the same. I mean, not to be all sort of CP Snow and
well, yeah.
two worlds about it, but I think what's kind of interesting to me about it is that level of antagonism. Mm. As someone who spends a lot of time reading the tech press and that kind of world, I see people writing about technology and about big companies who have no understanding of computers or software or whatever. And sometimes that's really good.
Mm.
And you get that outsider perspective, and sometimes it's just really naive. And then on the other side, like, there's a real distaste and disregard of pretty much any philosophy that isn't ancient Greek.
Mm.
In the tech world, like, there's just no interest in philosophy or like fiction that isn't sci-fi, or like contemporary art is just totally written off most of the time, and by people who are making just buckets of money.
Mm.
At like Facebook or Google or something. And I guess I'm wondering about, like, I've always wondered why there's such a friction between these two camps. Like, are they just like fundamentally different ways of seeing the world? Or do they just have like different sort of reward systems? Or would you even agree with that at all, that there is that kind of divide or friction?
No, I definitely do think, I mean, like the whole CP Snow, like thing of the two cultures, like, you know, it is like people talk about it as though it's outmoded now or whatever. And, you know, there were certain like successful attempts to bridge that gap, you know, often from the other side, often from like tech people. Mm. But in general, I think it's true. I mean, they're like, I, you know, I've, thought about this and, you know, experienced it, and sometimes written about it in my own work as well, the sense of being like an emissary from a foreign culture, you know, almost like an anthropological kind of thing where, you know, you're looking at this. I mean, obviously I sort of focus on, certainly in my first book, sort of quite extreme figures who are on the kind of outer fringes of even the tech world itself as ways of like representing sort of ideas that are actually more mainstream in that culture. But definitely I've often had a sense of like trying to translate these people and their ideas into my own language, into something I can identify with. And similarly, like, you know, I think like To Be a Machine was like received with sort of like wary kind of bafflement by tech people in general. I don't think it was read that widely by tech people, actually, to the extent that I could say like which demographics sort of embraced it. I would say like the big ones were contemporary artists and doctors, I think. Mm-hmm. For maybe obvious reasons, because it's about the body and stuff like that. But, you know, of the tech people who have read it that I know of, in like there's a sort of like slightly sort of wary kind of reception of it, I think. Like one of the most extreme examples I came across was like a friend of mine who lives in the Netherlands, said he bought a copy of it for his housemate, who's like a tech guy, an engineer. And he said that like the first line of the book is, "All stories begin in our endings. We invent them because we die," which seemed like a clever line at the time. I now don't really quite know what it means anymore. But he said that, like, you know, a few days later, he asked his flatmate, "So what did you think of that book? Did you start reading?" And he was like, "Yeah, I read the first sentence and it was complete bullshit. And I just closed it and I never opened it again." Because if he could say something that false in the first sentence, then I don't care what this guy has to say. Which is like the harshest thing anyone's ever said about my book. And that's only the first sentence. And I just thought that it was really, at the time, I was like sort of defensive about it and I kind of laughed it off. And I was like, well, you know, how could this, you know, obvious nerd have any appreciation of what I'm up to, which is like, you know, trying to welcome the reader into a realm of like ambiguity and play. Like if he's looking for, you know, mere truth propositions, well, he's come to the wrong place. And now I think back, now, you know, I've had to read the book again recently because I'm doing a theater adaptation of it. And like the first line has been one that I've kind of stuck on a bit. Like, what did I actually mean? But I thought at the time, like, I thought that was just an extraordinary reaction. Like, this is untrue, or this doesn't mean something I can pin down. So I'm not interested in reading this book. And some of the reactions that I've sort of seen, like, you know, Amazon reviews and stuff like that, is that like basically just kind of, where are the facts? I want to know about the technology. I want to know about how likely this stuff is. I don't want to know about this guy and his like reveries about, you know, 20th century philosophy or his kids or whatever. So there is a sense of like writing about a subject which is generally outside of the realm of like more literary kind of writing. And I think, I guess, like, as I say, one of the reasons I really like Roisin's work is that she's one of the people who's also doing that and doing it in a way that is like quite different to the way I do it, but like, I think really brilliant.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. And I think like, that's why it's so interesting that you've chosen this piece, I think, just because there are so many correspondences, I suppose, between...
Yeah, well, I mean, even the white whale thing. I mean, when I got to that, like, as I said, like, it had an air of like really compelling kind of inevitability. Not that it was predictable, but that like when I got there, I was like, ah, yes, this is where this has been building to, the white whale thing. There's a sort of a sense of recognition as well. Like in my new book, I don't go into it in anything like the detail that Roisin does, but Peter Thiel for me has been a kind of a white whale figure. Mm-hmm. And I have a similar kind of fascination with Thiel as a symbol, like in the same way that Roisin does with Zuckerberg in this piece. And I do kind of bump up against like Melville in my sort of attempt to grapple with the blankness of Thiel and like, you know, grappling with him in terms of like what he represents as opposed to like a person. Like I don't get the sense that Roisin like wants to write like a profile of Mark Zuckerberg and like, you know, get behind the scenes and like, you know, figure out what makes him tick or whatever. She is in a way that is quite similar to my fascination with Thiel. She's fascinated by the exterior, by the blank kind of shop front that he presents to the world. And I think that's like really interesting.
I guess these people, like people in their shoes, that they're obsessives. They're kind of like mavericks, you know, they're following their own path in this really concerted way. And this often, to my mind, kind of results in them sort of like turning away from the world in some way. The emergence of like a different and usually kind of difficult to understand set of values, like a different value system.
Hmm.
And like Zuckerberg fits that. I think Thiel absolutely fits that as well. They're people with like personal vision. And while that vision is kind of like shaping the world in a profound way, it's not like a vision of life that many people ultimately share. They're not like sympathetic figures.
No, for sure. And there is like, there are certain absolute similarities. I mean, they both present as quite robotic and blank, as I keep saying. They both often appear quite sweaty in public, which is interesting. And like Roisin goes into that in a really interesting way.
Yeah.
In her piece. The sweat is like definitely an interesting sort of epiphenomenon of both of these personalities. The sort of like weird, uncanny sheen that they sometimes present. In a way, Zuckerberg is the more horrifying figure because, you know, I talk about Thiel as like, you know, representing for me, like the sort of horror and the moral void at the heart of capitalism in my book. In the most recent book and to some extent in the first book as well. But I think actually Zuckerberg probably represents capitalism in a much more disturbing way because he's so hard to pin down. He's like, you know, capitalism doesn't have a worldview. You know, it insists on free markets and those kinds of things, but it doesn't have a contrarian take, you know? It's sort of like, it is that, as Roisin kind of gets at, it is that like Lovecraftian kind of mutability, that kind of like impossible to sort of define horror, because like, you know, we're seeing it at the moment with like all these brands adopting the language of, you know, Black Lives Matter, like so many brands who are like complicit and like actively pursuing like business practices that are like destroying the lives of like marginalized people, and they're adopting this language because it is, you know, the sort of currency at the moment, to use a kind of an ill-advised pun. And Zuckerberg sort of embodies that in a way. Mm. I think he embodies that sort of blankness and slipperiness and, you know, ability to sort of say nothing while sort of making the right noises about community and connectivity and so on.
Yeah. I mean, it's something that Roisin draws on in a big way is this idea of normcore, which is itself an extension of this mutability. This I think she describes it as the ability to not be picked up by CCTV, which isn't exactly what it is, but it's such a great way of describing it because it's about being invisible while being very visible, while making a statement. I mean, that's normcore is itself a style, like it's a fashion statement, which is blankness. It's like Facebook itself, in that Facebook is mundane. It's part of everyday life for like a billion people. It's no longer novel on an individual level, which kind of makes it harder to see how novel it is on a social level. And like that's kind of like true of tech in general. Like there's a mundane sort of bland aspect to how it works. Like it just works. It's just part of your daily life. And you can't, if you're thinking about it or writing about it, or you can't really rely so much on the kind of shock of the new as people might have been able to do in the past. Like, you know, if you're like reading something like the Whole Earth catalog or early sort of Wired issues, there's this just fascination with this stuff. It's brand new. It's like going to take over the world. It's going to recreate the world. And sort of what Facebook kind of embodies for me, at least, is not the recreation of the world, but like a sort of slow infestation, or like it kind of insinuates itself in the world rather than having any ideas about how it might change it for better or worse.
And I think we're at this really interesting, weird sort of point with our relationship with technology now, that we weren't at like when I wrote my book, and we weren't at when Roisin was writing this essay. And I think like that the language of like sort of starry-eyed, you know, we're going to change the world optimism around technology, like that's fallen away. You don't really hear that so much anymore, I think. Maybe I'm not as tuned into it, but it seems like people have stopped buying that a long time ago. And generally tech people have stopped using it. And like with the sort of situation that we're in now, like with, you know, international lockdown and the sort of increased like reliance on technology just to conduct our everyday business, I think we're in this weird place with it where like, I wonder, has my attitude towards technology somewhat shifted? I mean, like, we're doing this, even though we live on the same street, you know, we're doing this as though we are, you know, living across the world from each other, or at least in different cities or whatever. And, you know, like I'm writing a reported piece at the moment for a magazine, which involves like, you know, a lot of reporting and a lot of interviews with a bunch of people who live in my hometown of Kilkenny, and I can't go there, you know, for obvious reasons because of the virus, and I can't meet them in person. So it's all being done online. And like, I guess like throughout this whole interlude, or, you know, maybe it's optimistic to call it an interlude, but throughout this whole sort of period we're in, it just seems to me that like technology has become like everything that was already happening in terms of like technology's embeddedness in our everyday lives, everything that was happening sort of slowly and inexorably has suddenly started to happen really, really quickly. So like the sort of like the economy of presence and like bodily presence of like people being in rooms with each other, you know, whether it's like theater or like live music, or being in a bookshop, like consuming culture and like experiencing other people, all those things have, they haven't gone, but they've moved online and they've become like disembodied. And that was already happening, but it's just happened really, really, it's like, you know, someone has come into the cancer ward where the patient was like slowly dying and like hit him over the head with a hammer.
Yeah, definitely. I think we're at some sort of tipping point. I think one of the things that is interesting about this moment, and what I think one of the major reasons it's so different from that sort of early optimism thing is that when, for those early adopters and the people who saw it first, the changes and the technologies and stuff were happening at a scale that was, you know, very small comparatively. And therefore, they don't, when things are small and they don't intersect with like many other things, they're a lot purer and they're a lot sort of, they're more themselves, they're more perfect in themselves. Whereas when you get to the scale of Facebook, you're talking more, much, much more about politics and about history and about identity than you are about technology.
Yeah, like I'm kind of struck by the way you put it at the beginning, which is that, like, you know, a technology when it's in its early stages can exist in this kind of closed circuit or whatever. But like, so by definition, almost, if you have like a platform in which, like, it's like literally billions of people now are like communicate through which they're communicating and consuming news, like that is by definition political and has like unbelievably kind of deep political impacts. And I think that's the thing, like, you know, someone like Zuckerberg is like just not cut out for thinking through the implications of that. So there's something almost like comical in a sort of a cosmically horrific way of like the sheer like farce of someone of, like, let's be honest, Zuckerberg's like limited talents and like sort of, you know, mental like capaciousness or whatever, being like wielding such like unprecedented power, you know, political power. And his sort of stance towards it seems to be, well, I don't actually hold this power. The people hold this power. The people who use my platform hold this power, which is, you know, self-evidently a lie, I guess. And I don't, like, I think we have still not even really begun to scratch the surface of reckoning with how this, like, has impacted and, like, damaged what is left of democracy, you know? I think we may already, like, I sort of always very wary of, like, invoking future historians, but, like, I think, you know, we may already be past, we may already be on to the chapter of the history books where, like, the democracy chapter has ended and we're already in the kind of early part of the next chapter or whatever. I think certainly in the US, you know, like, America hasn't looked like a democracy to me in a long time. And you can't blame Facebook or, you know, Silicon Valley for all of that, obviously. But I think, like, similarly, like, the patient has been on the table for a long time and Facebook is with a hammer. You know?
Yeah, there's an accelerationist effect. As a final question, there's a phrase that Roisin uses in the essay, the God view, where she's talking about Zuckerberg's own view of the network that he's created and how that's been echoed in, say, Uber. But when I was reading it, it reminded me sort of the author's view, perhaps more so in fiction than in nonfiction, but like even there, you have like such a great deal of insight into the actions and behaviors of the people that you're writing about. And of course, like you have quite a bit of power to shape how those people are represented, at least in your own work, and, you know, how they're understood through that. But I was wondering, is that something that you can relate to? Or, you know, to put it another way, I mean, do you feel godlike when you write?
God, no, I wish I did. I mean, I'm thinking of that. I'm sure it's not an entirely serious question, but like, I was thinking of that James Joyce, you know, quote, the passage in The Portrait where he talks about the author, you know, godlike, drifting above his creation, paring his fingernails indifferently or whatever. Yeah. There's maybe a bit of that in Mark Zuckerberg, definitely not in me. No, I'm like, I don't know what I'm like. I definitely don't have a godlike view. I'm just sort of like wandering around in the sort of half dark sort of twilight. No, but like at the same time, I do have a sense of like, of, you know, the limited but not insignificant power of a nonfiction writer over how you represent people. And, you know, the tension between trying to, like, in some sense, create your characters and also, like, always bear in mind that they are real people who are probably going to read this, or at least, you know, encounter people who have read it. And, like, no one's ever happy with what you write about them, ever. Like, I've never encountered anyone who's like, that's not entirely true, but, like, basically it's weird and alienating to be written about. So I'm like, if I am a god, I'm extremely anxious and worried. God, definitely not Old Testament. Maybe some, like, minor, like, deity half forgotten from some civilization that never cut it.
Thank you very much, Mark, for your time. Really enjoyed talking to you.
Thanks, Ian. It was a pleasure to get to talk about someone else's work.
So that's about all we have time for right now. Big thanks to Mark for such an interesting discussion. I hope you enjoyed listening. And if you did, do subscribe to the Stinging Fly podcast wherever you usually listen to podcasts. If you really liked it, maybe tell your friends about it or leave a review. I want to mention, too, that our online archive featuring over 20 years of the best new writing is available to our subscribers. And you can subscribe through our website, stingingfly.org/subscribe. Thanks again to the Arts Council for their support, and thank you for listening. We'll see you next time.